Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Right Stream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann, broadcasting here from the beautiful Space Coast of Florida, Central East Florida Coast. I'm so glad you could join me today for another interesting and fascinating broadcast with a talented, intelligent, and knowledgeable author. Knowledgeable is a good word to describe my guest today. I think you're going to learn a lot from today's program, and we're going to focus again this week on nonfiction. As most of you know, I tend to bring mostly fictional authors onto the program, but you know, every so often I like to bring someone who's written a nonfiction book, especially one with as much relevance as the book we're going to discuss today. For anyone who's paying attention to current events, you'll be able to relate to some of the issues that we are going to be discussing this afternoon with author Charles R. Hooper, and we're going to bring him on the air here in just a few moments. But before I do, I just want to remind everybody that and tell you a little bit about me. For those of you who don't know me, I am an independent author, blogger, social media marketer, and founder of the Right Stream Radio Network, which went live on the air on Blog Talk Radio back in March of 2013. And right now we have 5 unique and interesting shows airing on the Right Stream Radio Network. And we start off the week on Sundays with Just Believe with author, metaphysician, and holistic health practitioner Lisa Tarvis, followed by Military Monday with author, military historian, and journalist John D. Gresham. He airs every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Of course, Right Stream Tuesday with me, yours truly, where we bring on authors from a variety of genres, and as I said, I also bring on nonfiction writers, as my guest is today, and we go live at 1 p.m. Eastern. And about 6 weeks or so ago, I added a new feature to Right Stream Tuesday called the Right Wing Riot at the urging of one of my good friends and writer buddies on Facebook and on Twitter, and he is known for the Right Wing Riot purposes as the Prince of White Bread. And of course, that's very tongue-in-cheek. For those of you who might not understand that, it's definitely humor. And he, along with his colleagues, Ms. Scary Smart and Ms. Always Right, bring their own unique brand of what they call public service satire to the airwaves. And so they go live in the second half of the show every week now on Right Stream Tuesday. And of course, we always welcome your calls. Hopefully you're listening to the entire show, the entire 2 hours. But whether you're listening to the first half or the second half, as long as the show is live, we encourage you to call in with your questions and comments at 347-945-7246. Wednesday evenings on the Right Stream Radio Network, licensed clinical psychologist Dr. Billy Eisenberg and family law attorney Sheena Benjamin Wise host Family Power Hour. It's a real informal call-in show that airs 7 p.m. every Wednesday night. It's not an advice show. However, they do bring on an expert in a particular field every week on things that are relevant to, you know, the human experience, and particularly if you're raising kids or if you're, you know, when you're dealing with relationships, which all of us are. So I encourage you to tune into Family Power Hour on Wednesday evenings. And then Lisa and I together co-host a fun women's lifestyle show called Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss on the network Friday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern. And to be quite honest, our schedules have been so busy that we have not been able to do a live show in quite some time. But we are going to be revamping and revising, and hopefully after Labor Day, we'll have some new episodes of Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss to get on the air. For more information, you can visit our website at rightstreamradio.com. That's W-R-I-T-E, stream.com. And if you're interested in learning more about me, you can visit my blog at dariadigiovanni.com. That's dariadigiovanni.com. I do a lot of different things. If you're looking for a ghostwriter, a blogger, editor, somebody to walk you through the independent publishing process, help you out with social media, set up a blog, you can find out all the different things that I do for clients at my website as well. So I'm very excited because I recently got a new client last week, and I'm very excited about her book, but I'm not going to say much about that right now because I would like to focus on my guest for today. So joining me today is an author named Charles R. Hooper, and he has written a book called The Next American Revolution, How to Demand Congressional Reform Now. And before I go ahead and bring him on the air, I just want to read a book description from Amazon.com where his book is available in both paperback and Kindle. In The Next American Revolution, Charles R. Hooper identifies the corrupted congressional electoral system as the culprit behind a failed national legislature. No matter how much Congress is despised or how dramatic elections appear to be, 80 to 90% of incumbents remain in office. Until reforms are made that alter how members of Congress are elected and how long they can serve in office, there will be no stopping a runaway Congress from ruining its own country. Hooper empowers Americans with the knowledge of a tool the Constitution's framers left to overcome a corrupt federal government. Through Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, Americans have the right and power to legally, safely, and effectively take back their Congress. Hooper argues that Americans should momentarily lay aside their partisan differences and focus their combined power toward one common cause, a revolution calling for a convention of the states specifically and solely for the purpose of proposing amendments that will restore Congress to the institution envisioned by the founders. The author dispels most of the myths surrounding Article 5 and effectively explains why this is the people's best and last hope of saving our country from a tyrannical Congress. So we, no doubt, are going to have a lot to discuss this afternoon. So without further ado, I welcome author Charles R. Hooper, which he has told me I can refer to him as Chuck, so I'm going to welcome Chuck Hooper to the program this afternoon. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Darren. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you? Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Chuck, I know you wanted me to call you Chuck on the air, and I just wanted to give out the correct name, though, on your book. So on the book, you're known as Charles R. Hooper. So, you know, tell us a little bit about – well, first, Chuck, give us a little bit about your background, because you have had a career as a social worker, correct? And so let's introduce yourself to the audience, and then we can talk about the book some more.
Right. Okay. I come from a military background. My father was a retired Marine, so I grew up with a very serious love of country, and went in the Navy myself, served off the coast of Vietnam in the Navy, and when I got home, I worked numerous jobs, finally put myself through undergraduate school, went on to UNC Chapel Hill, got my master's in social work, and worked in geriatric medical social work for over 20 years. So advocacy, trying to help others solve problems is what my life has pretty much been about. And, you know, I never in my life imagined that I would see my country in decline. You know, growing up, of course, on a Marine Corps basis, it just never crossed the radar. But that's what's happened. Over the last 20 years, our country, especially politically, is just absolutely disintegrating. And there doesn't seem to be anything we can do about it. And believe me, if there had been something I could have done about it other than voting, I would have, but it just seemed hopeless. So I stumbled on the idea of the Article 5 convention by researching different options, and I guess my wife got tired of hearing me gripe about it. She said, well, why don't you write a book about it? So I did. In 2009, I started it. It took me a year to write this book, and as I went along further in my research, I realized, you know, this is the only way we're going to save our government from destruction, or our nation from destruction, because when the nation was set up, the founding fathers realized that what we see now would happen, and they thought, now what can we do to give the people a way to make an end around a corrupt federal government when that happens? And so they developed Article 5 at the Constitutional Convention, and it allows the Constitution to be amended in two different ways. And the first is by Congress, which is the only way it's ever been amended, and they've They propose an amendment to the states after two-thirds of both houses agree to it. Then three-quarters of the states have to ratify it for it to become law. The other method is by a convention of the states. When 34 states, two-thirds of the states, apply for a convention to Congress, Congress must call a convention. It has no choice in the matter. And because we've never had a convention, that's essentially all we know about Article 5 and what will be involved, because the wording of the Constitution is very, very sparse. It just essentially says when two-thirds of the states call for a convention, we should have one. So the purpose of a convention is to do one thing and one thing only, and that's to propose amendments. It has no other powers. And it has the same authority as Congress when it comes to amendment proposals. They're sent out to the states. When three-quarters of the states, 38 states, ratify it, then it becomes part of the Constitution. For the longest time, I really did believe in the political system. I voted. I did some volunteer work and did what I could. But it just seemed like nothing was changing. Even when, whatever your politics are, whatever side of the aisle had control of the government, which they both have had back and forth in the last 30 years, nothing changes. When the Democrats had complete control, nothing happened. When the Republicans had complete control, same old stuff. So, it got me wondering, why is it that there's so much apparent dissension, but there's no change? And it occurred to me in my research that there is a reason, and it's because the members of Congress have our electoral system locked down. There's no other way for anybody besides a Republican or a Democrat to be elected into Congress except on very, very rare or unusual conditions. And even then, among the members of Congress, 90% of them are reelected election after election after election. And why is that? Since Congress is so despised, why do we keep voting these people back in? And there are reasons. It's because they monopolize the electoral system. We really, when we go into the voting booth, we don't really vote for members of Congress. We vote to validate tyranny. When we go in there and we pull the lever, we're saying it's okay for these people to go back and continue to do nothing except destroy the country. So that's what this book is about. I made it as short and as simple as I could. I wrote to just anybody that can read to read it, and it's a clear plan, and it will work. The problem is, of course, is that it's a very, very long shot. And by that I mean whether the people, some people, do we have an innocent, do we even have the guts to bring something like this about? Do we have George Washington out there? Do we have people that can pull us out of this? And I believe we do. They just don't have the chance because we're swallowed up by the electoral system in Washington. So this book is simply a plan, and it's a very clear plan. It's a very effective one, but unless a significant number of people get on board with the idea, which is happening, by the way, it's a long shot. So,
right. Now, Chuck, there's so much I want to say. It was such a full-bodied answer, and I have so many questions for you, so I want to try to put these in logical order. But, first of all, I don't know if you've listened to the popular AM talk show host, Mark Levin. I mean, he's one of my very favorites because I learned so much from him as a constitutional attorney. So is this similar to what he's been promoting? Are you aware that he's been pushing for a convention?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So is this the same thing? Is this what you're suggesting?
Mm-hmm.
Similar?
That's what I said, it is happening. Mark Levin's Liberty Amendments is one of those efforts. And his pattern pretty close to what I'm saying. So there's a lot of agreement about what to do.
Excellent. Now, one of my other questions, as I was reading your book, which I highly recommend to everyone, by the way, and if you've got a 5-star rating on Amazon, it is available in Kindle and paperback. I did put a link to it in the chat room, so I encourage everyone to buy this book. But, one of the things that occurred to me, Chuck, and maybe I've just become too cynical because I've been an activist pretty much my whole life thanks to my mother, and my dad, but, you know, my mom had more time to be involved, constitutional activists, you know, constitutional conservatives. But, you know, when you say you put aside partisan differences, and I mean this as a sincere question, because I really believe, especially in the last, say, 50 to 60 years, there's been a concerted effort to undermine American institutions, American culture, to make kids in school believe that we're a bad country, the founding fathers were all racist, and we're at a point where I believe that almost 50% of the country, their idea of the role of government is diametrically opposed to what the Constitution proposes. So when you say, you know, put aside our partisan differences, and believe me, I have no love for the Republican Party. I'm barely hanging on by a thread in my registration because I think they're both totally corrupt. I don't really see much of a difference between either one of them, frankly. But, you know, how do you square that circle when so much of the population thinks it is the federal government's job to, you know, buy your gas and pay for your mortgage and take care of you from cradle to grave? How do you square that circle?
Well, fortunately, you can square it because square the circle, that's pretty good. the reason that we have such a dependent society is because we have a Congress that is completely out of touch with anything besides gaining power. And the only way you're going to gain power in a society is to make the people dependent on a government. And so, you know, from that point of view, that's what's happening. But when I say set aside partisan differences, I don't mean a kumbaya moment where we all unrealistically drop what we believe in our hearts and go after a pipe dream. I'm talking about where we do, as we've done many times in the past, where we have been able to set aside our differences and work towards the common goal that's greater, really is greater than our own personal desires and beliefs, and that is the survival of liberty. So we did it beginning with the revolution, when there were people with all sorts of different beliefs who came together to fight the British. All the way through history, you know, where people have set aside differences, stark differences, to achieve a common goal. It's happened, you know, in the trenches, in combat, people don't worry about their party. You know, there's a common enemy. So we the people, whatever your party is, you have to have a Congress that does its job, whether you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, which we're supposed to have, by the way. We're supposed to think differently. The time to be afraid in America is when we all start thinking the same. But whatever your party, whatever the differences, you have to have a legislature that synthesizes all these differences and governs the nation, serves the people. Well, you know, we don't have that. And so by achieving a Congress, essentially a citizen's legislature, which is what my book is about, is how we restore a citizen's legislature, which we did have once. Until we do that, it doesn't matter what your politics are. It doesn't matter if you're left, right, Republican, Democrat. You're irrelevant. You know, you just don't matter. All you do is you go every 2 years, you pull the lever, you validate this fouled up system, and on we go towards disaster. And you know, I hear all kinds of great ideas, and there are great ideas on how we can fix Congress, what we need to do to fix Congress, for instance, term limits, you know, real campaign finance reform. But none of those things are going to come from Congress. And they're the only people who can make these changes, reforming the executive branch, reforming the judicial branch. None of this is going to happen without Congress. And when Congress is completely devoid of the will of the people, none of these things are going to happen. So I think we can set aside our partisan differences because we've done it before. And we can work together to focus, laser focus, on fixing the institution that is supposed to do the things that we want it to do. So there's your answer. Sorry.
Okay. No, excellent. Well, no, it was a good answer. You know, and one of the things I like that you do, and it kind of ties in with my question in the book, is that you sort of give a civics lesson, which unfortunately civics has been sorely missing in the American educational system, which, by the way, should not be controlled by the federal government, but we don't have to delve into that right at the moment. But there's an example of federal overreach right there. You know, and so can you just give sort of, for anybody who's not aware of, you know, the concept of the separation of powers and the three branches of the government, Chuck, just give us an overall description of how our system is supposed to work.
Oh, how it's supposed to work. Okay, the way it was designed to work was an extremely well-tuned series of checks and balances at different levels. For instance, the three branches of government, of course, executive, judicial, and legislative, balance one another out. Also, the federal system the federal structure of our government, whereas the states, their powers as compared to the federal government, a limited federal government is supposed to, so that those are the two major checks and balances. There are others, the will of the people, supposed to be able to have the ability to toss them out, right? I mean, that's what elections are about. That is the ultimate power that was supposed to belong to the people. The ultimate check belongs to the people. Well, when you strip away, first of all, when the federal system breaks down, when the national government overwhelms the system, the states, that's lost. When the three branches of government lose sight of their powers and break their bounds, like, for instance, the judiciary, which is, I mean, just absolutely devastating the nation with these sweeping decisions. A president who's out of control, who, again, legislates, and a Congress that is completely paralyzed in partisan bickering. I mean, they are just... all these checks and balances, they're not checking, they're not balancing. Nothing's being checked. But the only thing that's happening is this enormous, monolithic, cancerous, growing government that, no, there is no check, there is no balance. And
no, there isn't. I mean, and they're both, both parties have become parties of big government. To me, the only difference is one is moving faster than the other, but they're both moving in the same direction. Neither one of them is serving. You know, it's all become, when I hear somebody, a commentator or on television, or I watch a video on the internet, when I hear the phrase, well, what's good for, for example, the Republican Party, I just want to, beat my head against the wall, because I don't give a damn what's good for either party. I care about what's good for the country and its citizens. And, and Chuck, in your book, I mean, I love Chapter 2, which is entitled, Who Does Congress Really Listen To? Very enlightening. I mean, because people need to be aware of this because, supposedly we elect these people to represent us. And you're right, Congress, especially the House of Representatives, I mean, they come up for election every 2 years. I would say they're the closest to the people. And yet, you're right. We end up with, every time an election rolls around, most people find themselves having to vote for the lesser of two evils, and yet we're stuck. If you vote third party or you write somebody in, it's basically throwing away your vote, and there just doesn't seem to be any end to this madness. But and we can talk more about the proposed convention, but I wanted you to kind of expound upon the different groups that they really listen to, and unfortunately, constituents are not at the top of that list. So why don't you take us through some of that?
Right, constituents are at the bottom of the list. At the top of the list of who Congress really listens to is themselves. We've made service in Congress far, far too lucrative. When Congress was first set up, they didn't even have a salary. They were paid $6 a day only while they were in session. And it was truly a citizen's legislature, and it was that way at least the first 100 years of the history of the Republic. I'm having a weird buzzing noise at my end, but they serve themselves. It's all about re-election. It's all about power. It doesn't matter how third party or how independent somebody is when they are elected. It doesn't take long before they're swallowed up by the system, and off they go, become part of the problem. So yes. They listen to themselves first, their own interests. It pays too much. It has too much power. It's too easy to stay there forever, and you end up becoming a tool for your own party. By the way, which is the second constituency is their party. K Street, the people that pay for it all.
So what is K Street, Chuck? Yeah. Explain that a little bit more, because I don't think a lot of people understand what K Street is.
Yes.
And how influential they are.
Sorry about that. Yeah, K Street is the street in Washington, D.C., where it's just group after group of lobbyists and special interest groups. These are the people who actually pull the strings in Washington. And they're right down the street, literally. And they all know one another. You know, the lobbyists, some of those are former members of congressional staffs and vice versa. So it's a pretty close-knit system. And we've made it too easy for people completely outside of a district to come in and influence a member of Congress's decisions. You know, when you go and you volunteer your time at the voting booth, you donate $500, whatever, it seems a lot, which it is to you personally, but when you have one special interest that can come in and put up $10,000 or more, far more, and they're not even in the district, you don't stand a chance against K Street. K Street is the other constituency, the one that's really, truly more important beyond themselves to members of Congress. And, of course, then the party is the next in the list, and they, as you well know, the party comes into major play. A lot of times people will toss away their convictions to support a party platform. That's how independents and third party people are swallowed up, is to make things happen. They have to compromise to the needs of the party. And so the party ends up controlling a member of Congress more than constituents. Mm-hmm. At the very, very bottom of the list are us. And like I say, our power is essentially limited to the voting booth, letters to Congress, meaningless petitions, a lot of noise and a lot of smoke, but no change. So, yeah.
Okay. Right, or change for the worse, which seems to be the track we're on now. We're on a fast track to destruction at this point in time. And I wanted to keep talking about your book, so I won't get into, hopefully if we have time, we can get into some current pressing issues. But I wanted to make sure I asked you, Chuck, because this was new to me. I did not, when I was reading your book, I was not aware of something, and I hope I pronounced this correctly, the Duverger effect?
Duverger effect, yeah.
Duverger effect.
Right, go ahead.
No, please explain what that is and why that's so dangerous to our system of representative government.
Well, you know, our system has evolved, our electoral system has evolved into a system where there's two parties. And, you know, I don't have any beef with the two-party system, but the problem is when people, it's essentially the Duverger effect is where the people are forced to vote for, they're voting against somebody as opposed to for somebody. They have their choices become narrowed down to where they have only two choices, and they can't. Let's say like you had three candidates on a ballot, okay, and one of them was the one you really, really supported. They preached the ideas that you believe. They're the person you would really love to see in Congress, but you know they don't stand a chance. You know it. So you can either not vote, or you can go and vote for this person and essentially throw away your vote, which is voting for the other side, or you can go in there and you can pull for the other, you know, pull for your party that's closest to what you believe and has the strongest chance of winning, but is still miles away from what you would like to see happen. So that happens in every election, and that's how most elections are, is people are going in the voting booth not to vote for what they believe, but to vote against what they don't want to see. So that's sort of a summarized view of that.
Sure. And that, you know, and that gets back to the whole lesser of two evils things, and that whole concept has been exploited by people for their own self-interest. You know, I'm thinking of the Karl Rove of the world, who I won't even discuss on the air my feelings about him, you know, but just to use that as an example, and the attitude is, well, you're going to vote for this person? You know, and I don't like how these parties kind of foist who they want onto, you know, registered members within their party as well. I mean, even the primary system seems rigged to me. I mean, would you agree that that's true, or you know, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, I do agree with that. Like, for instance, a third party or independent candidates on the ballot is almost unheard of, congressional ballot. In North Carolina, we haven't had other than one senatorial candidate that I know, we've never had a third party or an independent candidate on a congressional ballot. So, and that's typical for all the states. They can't get on the ballot. And so...
Yeah.
I,
That's okay, Chuck. You know, the other thing that you reminded me, something you said, I mean, it's so expensive for the average person. You know, I also think that we don't get good, decent people elected because it's too damn expensive for them to even run. I mean, I know, I think in the state of Florida where I live, you have to have 10,000 signatures before you can even, like, consider running. I mean, it's like the odds are stacked against your good, decent, say a small business owner who really wants to run for the right reasons and become sort of that citizen legislature envisioned by the founders. I mean, it's next to impossible for this person to even run because it's prohibitive financially.
Right, and beyond financially, they can be crushed by the two parties. I mean, look who somebody would be going against. They can destroy you. They can destroy your reputation. Anybody that has any skeleton in the closet, they have the power and the means to go after. They can lock you up in court over technicalities on ballot access. They design the districts to keep themselves in power. There are a lot of good people out there that would serve, could serve, if they could get on the ballot. But even if they got on the ballot, they probably don't stand much of a chance.
Yeah, that is a really sad commentary on our current the state of our political system today. Right. Now, I wanted to ask you, Chuck, I had another question because the 17th Amendment, I found that very interesting in your book because in my course of my activism, I've had people who felt very passionately that was the beginning of the end, and I think you're arguing the opposite. I mean, I've been around people, activists, who believe strongly in limited government and are doing everything in their power to try to restore it, and they don't like the fact that senators are no longer, sent to Washington by the state legislature. Now, you seem to be arguing for the opposite. Can you explain the 17th Amendment and your position on it?
Well, the 17th Amendment, the direct election of senators, there was a big push for this during the Progressive Era in the early part of the 20th century. Everybody got at the state level, got the idea that there was a lot of nationalist movement going on and the idea that senators should be directly elected by the people. Prior to that, senators were elected by the state legislatures. And the reason for that was so that the Senate would balance out the House, which was of the people in the states, whereas the Senate was of the states. It represented the states themselves. So when we took that away, when that was taken away with this amendment, it was actually I really don't support the 17th Amendment. I would support a repeal of it. But when we took that away, we took a major pillar of federalism. In other words, the balance of power, the checks and balances between the states and federal government, we took it away. So that just increased the power of the national government. And as you can see, senators now are about as far away from their states as you could possibly get. They're people of the party, people of country.
No, I apologize, Chuck, because I clearly misunderstood that in the book. So, yeah, because I have to say in the Tea Party movement and the things that I've been involved in, I've heard person after person say that was the worst thing that happened, that we need to go back to the state legislatures. Because you're right. I mean, these senators, they get elected, too, and they forget all about the home state, and they're all about, getting caught up in the belly of the beast there in Washington, D.C., and the lobbyists, which, of course, the House of Representatives is not immune to either, but... So you would argue for a repeal of the 17th Amendment then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I would.
Okay, so that makes sense. Yeah, and it would make much more sense for them to be closer to the states. Because honestly, I mean, and let's talk a little bit, too, about the Constitution and how it clearly defines the role of the federal government. Can you, just for our listeners, Chuck, kind of just state that, give a brief summary of really what, according to the Constitution, the federal government's role is as opposed to the states?
Right. Well, that was the critical thing at the convention. One of the most critical elements was the balance of power between the federal government and the states. At that time, the states were very powerful, and they were very jealous of their independence, which they should have been. And they had just fought this bitter war to break away from a tyrannical king, and the last thing they wanted was a tyrannical federal government. So when they wrote the Constitution, at the convention, there were two factions mainly. There were people who believed in a strong federal government, and there were people who believed in a strong states and a federal government that was closer to what was under the Articles of Confederation, a weak central government. Okay, well, the convention was dominated by Federalists, people who believed in a strong federal government, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison. These people, I wouldn't say ran over the people who believed otherwise, but they believed in a strong federal government. So when you look at the Constitution, you'll see that it did create a central government far more powerful than under the Articles of Confederation. Yet, much delicate compromising went into retaining power to the states. So when they came out, when the Constitution came out of the convention, it was just this beautiful, fine-tuned balance between these two powers. And the federal government, in spite of the Federalists' desire to make it more powerful, they made it powerful enough. What they mainly wanted to do was limit it to the powers that they wanted it to have, you know, defense, to promote commerce between the states, to resolve differences between the states. And that's how it was set up. It was set up to be this fine balance, leaning towards the states in some ways and towards federal government in other ways. And it worked. It did work for some time, but it slowly tilted more and more to the federal government over time. The Civil War really, really shifted power to the central government, and then it's never left. And then, of course, during the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal, then the Great Society under President Johnson, these things have made the states almost like toys of the federal government. It's almost pitiful. I mean, it really is almost pitiful, the difference between what was envisioned and what we have now.
Yeah, you know, as Ronald Reagan said, that all of us need to remember that the states created the federal government. The federal government did not create the states, and we are so far from that. But Chuck, I want to ask you this question, too. Would you say, I mean, do you think it's an accurate assessment that the year 1913 was really sort of the turning point in the wrong direction?
1913. Help me out there.
With the Federal Reserve, the creation of the Federal Reserve, and Woodrow Wilson, and then World War I, you know, would you say that sort of pushed us sort of towards FDR and all of, you know, the big government programs that we saw in the 20th century and that we're dealing with now?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, like I said, beginning before the Civil War, but the Civil War really, really locked the federal government in as the powerful entity it was to become. And the Federal Reserve, the Senate becoming beholden more to the national government than to the state legislatures, all of these things eroded the power of the states and led to just really a cancerous takeover by the time of FDR. That was essentially all she wrote. I mean, even President Eisenhower saw what was coming and warned the people repeatedly, you know, watch out what's happening. You know, this federal government's become a monolith of, you know, the military-industrial complex, and he wasn't just talking about that, though. He's talking about just where we, the people, become subservient because of need, where we all become, where we need the federal government. We should never need the federal government. I mean, that's my belief. It has its roles, but as individuals, it's really hard to justify, when you think about it, a need for the federal government. The state should be able to do just about everything as far as police, you know, police activities, social welfare, those kinds of things.
Right.
Should be powers of the state. So when we surrender these things to the federal government, we surrender our security, we surrender our independence and our liberty. It's all going down the tubes. Ronald Reagan supported the convention, by the way.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Ronald Reagan supported a convention.
Oh, he did. Another reason. Another reason to love the guy. Oh, and Eisenhower did too. That's very, very interesting. Yeah, and Chuck, what ends up happening too is that, you know, and it's like this vicious cycle because they use other people's money to keep buying votes. You know, I mean, we're paying for, you know, you and I as taxpayers, you know, against our will, a lot of, you know, and let me bring up a controversial topic that I think is a states' rights issue, regardless of how somebody feels personally about the matter, and that's abortion. The federal government forces you as a taxpayer, whether you believe in it or not, to fund abortion, to fund Planned Parenthood. I believe in the year 2012, they raked in $542 million from taxpayers alone. And then what do they do with that money? They give it to progressive politicians so that they can get elected or reelected to further erode our freedoms. Now, that's just one example, and I don't bring that up so that we can have a debate about abortion. I'm simply saying, I mean, to me, that's one of those social issues that's been used as a wedge that if it was properly given back to the states where it always belonged, we wouldn't be dealing with that kind of a problem.
Right.
Do you agree with that? Or?
Yes, I do. But see, none of these things are going to happen as long as we have a Congress that is no longer the agent of the people. It's supposed to be our agent in Washington. It's supposed to be serving us. Well, as you say, as we know, it's not. And so what do we do about it is the question, and that's what this book is about, is what do we do about it? And there's nothing we can do about it with the current system. The only way we can change things is with the tool that the founders left for us to use. They would be horrified and ashamed of us that we've not exercised this power, because for many of them at the convention, it was the most important power in the Constitution, the power of the people to circumvent the national government and propose amendments to fix these things. And I only proposed three amendments just as samples or examples, you know, term limits, campaign finance reform, and change in the way districts are drawn. Those are the three ways, those are the three methods that incumbency is maintained, and you have these people that, you know, they're wheeling them into the halls of Congress. I mean, they're so old, and they've been there so long, some of them. It's embarrassing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, look at what happened. I mean, and you look, you know, just a recent example of just rampant corruption is what we saw play out in Mississippi when we had somebody dare challenge an incumbent who's been in elected office, I think, since, you know, before I started grade school, which is a really long time, and just been feeding at the public trough that long. And, you know, his own party, now this was a primary, paid for ads to call this, you know, upstart conservative guy a racist, and they got out the vote from, you know, so much corruption went on in Mississippi. We don't have to get into all of it here, but what I'm saying is, I mean, it's just another example of how far gone this system is. I mean, I fully support your idea. So I guess, Chuck, my next question for you is, where are we at? I mean, what progress have we made toward making this convention a reality, and how far do we have to go?
Well, that's the exciting part. There is a rumbling going on that's louder than what we've heard before. We've come close to conventions, much closer than people think. We came within one state during the reapportionment movement in the 50s and 60s, where the states called for convention to change the way members were apportioned, and the same with the balanced budget amendment. We came within two states. And where we're at right now is there are, beginning with a conference at Harvard University where they brought together all these different elements, right, left, center, just to see, can we even talk about a constitutional convention, let alone have one? And it was a very successful conference, and people left there, you know, believing that, hey, maybe this could work. And since then, 100 legislators met in Washington recently to lay out some of the groundwork, state legislators, to lay out some of the groundwork for a convention. Mark Levin's book, which is, you know, a major movement, beginning a major movement from the right side towards a convention. My book, which came out in 2010, and lots of activity, lots, in fact, so much concern that Congress, the Congressional Research Service, has published or printed a track recently on how Congress should react to a convention call. What, you know, what should it do? You know, what, and its role, what, you know, what can it do to make it happen if it's called for? So it's happening. It's a slow process. It's very sluggish, and there's a lot of fear out there. There's a lot of myths, irrational information about the convention clause, and that kind of talk has been pretty successful in keeping a lid on it. But I think when people realize that we can do nothing about this runaway Congress unless we have a convention, which would be composed of elected delegates from the states, the runaway Congress is going to run us off the track, run us off the cliff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're on the edge. We're on the edge.
So now, what are some of the biggest myths that people harbor about this type of a convention? Give us some of the myths, the biggest myths, and how your rebuttal to those.
Okay. Well, the biggest one, of course, is the fear of a runaway convention, and even among scholars that are very familiar with the article and the intent of the founders, lots of debate. You know, let's say we have a convention for a balanced budget amendment, okay? Can we limit the delegates to just proposing amendments that would balance the budget? Or would they get in there and would they just go berserk and propose every kind of amendment that you can think of, the Second Amendment or revising the First Amendment? Just gutting the Constitution entirely. Well, none of that is realistic because ultimately a convention only has one power. It can only propose amendments. So when those amendments go out to the states, it takes 38 states to ratify them. It's very hard to ratify an amendment. So the power of ratification is the ultimate stop, but there are other stops. The states can commission their delegates to restrain them. The convention itself will probably most likely be a restrained event because it's, like everything else in politics, it's going to have multiple points of view. But the idea that they get together for the purpose of restoring the citizens' legislature is appealing to the states. And I think once something like that happens, it'll be extremely historic. All eyes will be on it. I don't think a convention is going to be as far out as people think. There's been hundreds of state conventions, not over my life. I have no fear of it. In fact, I'm willing to roll the dice at this point because I know otherwise we have nothing. We have a Congress that's run away. So we've got to do something there.
Exactly. No, I absolutely agree with you, Chuck. I wanted to say that one of my friends is she has a full-time job. She's a full-time activist, and she's starting a new company. And she's been involved in she's been very involved in the Common Core issue, just to put this out as an example. Now, she is a very staunch constitutional conservative, but what she found in putting this book together, which is a collection of essays from people all across the political spectrum, was that there was common cause with Common Core. So it seems very similar. The concept here is that I think that no matter, and what you're saying, put aside the partisan differences, I think the time is ripe for a convention because I do think people are waking up and realizing, hey, wait a minute, there's more that we agree upon than we disagree on. And and my friend, her name is Kirsten Lombard, by the way, resounding books, but, she says her opinion is that, the powers that be purposely keep people sort of in battled against each other because it suits their, it suits their own purpose. It keeps feeding their power. And the more we can cut through that, we the people, the better off we're all going to be, and of course our country. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think this football game mentality that the two parties have fostered on us, it serves their interests. I mean, it seems like they disagree. It seems like that they stand up for certain principles and these kinds of things, but in the long run, they don't. They are remarkably similar in the long run, the two parties in Washington. So, I firmly believe that, yeah.
So, Chuck, we have about 5 minutes left. Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you would like to mention on the air?
Well, I believe that the people that are listening, if they really want to effect change, if they want to rescue our government from corruption, then they need to learn about Article 5, what the founders meant. They need to look at the myths about it, the arguments for and against it. They need to educate themselves about it because I believe it's coming. So the more we know about it in advance, the more we can play an important role in making it happen, keeping it focused and achieving the goals that we all want. One of the worries about a convention is that people are going to go in there with all these different agendas, you know, abortion on demand or taking away, our Second Amendment rights. We've got to just focus. You know, our problem is Congress. Yes, the president's terrible, and the Supreme Court, something's got to be done. But until we reform Congress, we can't do anything about those two branches. It's the Congress
that can
do that. So we've got to hone in on Congress, and we've got to understand that we have a tool that we can use to make it happen and to pay attention to what's going on because there is a movement. It's a very strong movement, the Convention of the States movement, Friends of the Article 5 Convention. These are websites that you can go to. These are very powerful, growing powerful organizations that are pushing for a convention. So I think education is the best thing I can recommend is for people to not just read my book, but get their hands on everything they can find about it.
Absolutely, I agree. But I again want to recommend to my listeners, though, to please get Chuck's book. It's called The Next American Revolution, How to Demand Congressional Reform Now, and it's available on Amazon.com and Kindle and paperback. So please get it. And Chuck, you know, one of the things I love is that you include the Constitution at the end, which is, I just think is awesome.
Yes.
So it's and what you've done is so valuable because, you know, and this is on purpose, you know, getting back to the Federal Department of Education, civics is not being taught in school anymore. Proper history is not being taught in school anymore, certainly not proper American history.
Right.
When you think about it, this country is a miracle. Our founding fathers were not perfect. They were human beings, but they did conceive of something unheard of in history, and that is a nation with a system of government where the individual is in control of his or her own destiny, not a despot, not a monarch, you know, not an oligarchy, not a dictatorship. And we've gotten so far away from just genuine appreciation for what they left us. And my opinion is the least we can do is honor their legacy by making this convention happen and returning this country to the system they put in place.
Well, if I could, I'd like to end with a quote I have at the beginning of the book, a quote of Daniel Webster. It's, "Hold on, my friends, to the Constitution and to the Republic for which it stands. Miracles do not cluster, and what has happened once in 6,000 years may not happen again. Hold on to the Constitution, for if the American Constitution should fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world." And that's all this is about, us hanging on to the Constitution.
Well, amen to that. Very, you know, I'm glad we ended with that quote, Chuck. Excellent. And thank you so much for joining me today. But before I let you go, where can readers, listeners find you on social media if they want to connect with you?
My Facebook page is, they can look up Charles Hooper. They'll see it. It'll come up in a search. I'm at Chuk26 on Twitter, and I don't remember my LinkedIn profile, but I'm on LinkedIn as well. But if they want to order the book, Amazon's the place to go. And if they want a signed copy, I'll be happy to send them one. All they have to do is email me at hooperchuck@hotmail.com. And beyond that, good luck, America.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Chuck. I really enjoyed the interview. Very informative. And hopefully, I hope all my listeners will go out and get your book and more importantly, kind of put it into practice as soon as possible so that we can save this beloved country.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Darren.
Have a great afternoon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Chuck, otherwise known as Charles R. Hooper, on his book, The Next American Revolution, How to Demand Congressional Reform Now. Please find that at Amazon.com. It is in Kindle and paperback. All right, well, my goodness, that first hour of RightStream has flown by. I want to take this opportunity to let you know that next week, and I'm really excited about this, author Daniela Bova will be joining me as we get back into fiction, but it's really based on scary reality. But we're going to be talking about her fictional novel called Tears of Paradox, which is the first in a series that she's writing. Really, really excited about that. It's another book that has a 5-star rating on Amazon, and it has several reviews, and you can check it out there. It's Daniela Bova, Tears of Paradox, and we'll be talking more about that next week on RightStream Tuesday. So I will be back here. Gosh, I can't believe today's August 5th already. I'll be back here on Tuesday, August 12th at 1 p.m. Eastern. Stay tuned for the right wing riot. Try saying that fast three times and see how that works out for you. But I'm very excited. The Prince of White Bread, Ms. Scary Smart, and Ms. Always Right will be coming at you with some public service satire here in the second hour of RightStream Tuesday. So stay tuned, everybody, and thanks for listening.
Welcome to another edition of The Right Wing Riot with your hosts, the scary smart Jamie K. Wilson.
Every morning when I get late, should I go in and report to my boss?
the mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right.
Do we think that this is going to start being as obviously stupid to everyone as it is to us?
And Griff Griffiths, who is the Prince of White Men. Let's get this riot started!
Hello.
Hello.
I think our producer's asleep at the switch. Igor!
Oh,
dude. The show's starting. Okay, well, welcome once again to another edition of... You know, I just can't get this guy a raise this year. I'm sorry. I just can't.
What is he, union or something? Can't you get rid of him?
Well,
nah. I'm sure he works.
It was affirmative action, you know, that limp. I just had to. But I digress. Welcome once again to another edition of the Right Wing Riot with your previously announced hosts, Scary Smart Jamie K. Wilson. Give a shout out.
Hey, dudes.
Okay, the level of enthusiasm is really going to blow the speakers out today. And back from her undisclosed location, researching undisclosed things, Ms. Always Right.
And we are kicking out the jams.
And I'm feeling as hip as can be. I've got the platters that matter, the stacks of wax. But this is the Prince of White Bread, and we have another exciting full week of things to make fun of.
Mm-hmm.
It never stops, does it?
It really doesn't.
It's like a steady supply.
Wow. It's the cornucopia of corruption and incompetence.
I like that.
Right here. And we've gathered it all up into one tasty basket for you. And that would, of course, be the guys over at the NSA, Fernando, Daryl, Charles, and Alex, a new guy reporting in from San Francisco. So welcome to the show,
Alex.
Guys.
Hey,
yeah.
Hey, guys.
Appreciate you listening, and keep those emails and subpoenas coming. So, speaking of people listening in, have you heard about the CIA spying on the Senate?
I don't think that's possible. Doesn't that only happens when there is a Republican in the White House? That can't happen.
No, it can't happen because according to the CIA's charter, which was signed, I want to say, roughly 1950 by Harry S. Truman, they are forbidden by law, by statute, by all those old-fashioned things that you know, we can safely ignore today.
Yeah.
Unless you're a Republican. The CIA's charter forbids them from engaging in activities on U.S. soil. The reason for that was Harry Truman had actually kind of, you know, he fought in the First World War, and then he'd seen the results of the Second World War, and he had a little familiarity with Uncle Joe Stalin's activities in Russia, and he said, you know, I don't want a police state, because on one hand we've got J. Edgar Hoover, who, you know, was sort of unsavory in his own way, and he had those famous filing cabinets full of dirt on every politician. And that guy had enough power, and the idea of having an actual spy agency, not a law enforcement agency, but an agency dedicated to spying and intelligence gathering, working on the U.S. soil, just made Harry Truman a little uncomfy. So that was definitely part of the charter, was they are forbidden from us working on U.S. soil and basically spying on U.S. citizens in America. But apparently that doesn't apply anymore.
No. Well, it only applies if you actually prosecute it.
What are you actually trying to imply there, Scary Smart? I'm not sure I'm following your line of reasoning.
Oh, I'm not implying anything. I'm just, you know, saying that you have to prosecute it first, and the guy that's in charge of prosecution would be Eric Holder, and Eric Holder answers directly to the president.
So if a law is broken and no one prosecutes, was there ever really a law?
Exactly.
Wow, so you're saying the Pope is a Catholic bear. Is that what you're telling me?
What?
Yeah, that works.
Sorry, I drifted off into Dadaism there for a minute. So, let me review this a little
just a little bit for, you know, the guys at the NSA, they probably know this already since they were looking at my computer earlier with the help of the CIA. So the CIA director named John Brennan, he kept telling the Senate, no, of course we're not spying on you. Of course we haven't hacked Senate computers, the very same Senate computers that are being used to investigate the CIA. That's just nonsense. That's crazy talk. I mean, that's the Taliban wing of the Republican Party just trying to make us look bad.
Yep.
And then this week they said, oh, no, wait a minute. I was just handed this unclassified summary that says that five agency employees, two lawyers, and three computer specialists. There's a joke in there somewhere. How many government employees does it take to hack Senate computers? They improperly accessed Intelligence Committee computers. And, you know, Brennan actually had ordered a halt to the operation, but the CIA's – now, this is going to be really an oxymoron. The CIA's Office of Security investigated anyway because they were, quote, unaware of the director of the CIA's direction to stop spying on American soil on American legislators.
So you're telling me they're like the president? They didn't even know about that order until they saw it on the news?
I'm guessing not.
Yeah.
They should have spied on the computer of the person who gave the order, and then they would have heard it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
They might have had to talk to the NSA to have that happen, but I'm not sure. So, wow. That,
maybe
that,
they just lost all the emails.
You know, they may have. There's,
that's
there's
probably
a rash of that going around.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
computer crashes.
They, you know, they are a curse. You know, we're all prisoners of technology. Now, what I found particularly amusing is, first, Feinstein, Senator Barbara Feinstein, basically said, well, that's cool. I got an apology from the director of the CIA, so, you know, no harm, no foul. Let's keep going.
This was
another nice one from a Democrat from Oregon named Senator Ron Wyden, and I'm going to quote this because it's awesome. What's needed now is a public apology from Director Brennan to the staff and the committee, that is the deeply aggrieved legislators, a full accounting of how this occurred, and I want to bold this, I don't have a bold voice, a commitment. There will be no further attempts to undermine congressional oversight of CIA activities. Now, a commitment. Are these guys dating? You know, I mean, are they saying, no, you know, we're monogamous, we're special, we're not going to spy on anybody else anymore? We read your email.
The law in place, I thought, would have made that not necessary.
Yeah, that commitment, that's like, we're married, I'm sorry I cheated on you, I won't do it again.
Yeah. Whereas there's already a law against them. But yes, of course, I see what you're saying. Commit themselves to following the law.
Okay, and to touch on what Jamie said, so somebody, the findings of this investigation by the CIA's Inspector General were shared with the Justice Department, the DOJ, headed by Eric Holder, and do you know what they did? What did they do?
Nothing.
They declined to pursue criminal charges.
I cannot believe that. That is out of character.
I know.
Yeah,
and, you know, this is the most ethical, the most transparent administration in history.
Yes.
And, you know,
they say so.
All Obama must have been having a bad golf day or something. I mean, his attention was not laser focused on one of the 500 things he's been laser focused on throughout his entire administration. So let's see.
He must look like a disco ball inside his head, you know.
He's blinded by his own light, that's for sure.
That's the truth.
Oh,
yeah.
That's why they got all those pictures of him. Remember the pictures that had the halo coming around?
The halo.
Yes.
I love
that's
those.
That's what that was. Those
yes.
are the laser focuses.
That they are. He was really was laser focused before laser focusing was cool.
Yeah.
But so let's see if we can sum this up. The CIA violates its charter, which has been in place since 1950.
Mm-hmm.
But the Department of Justice, which has been in place, well, it's been getting more and more transparent from the last 6 years. The DOJ doesn't see anything to investigate. So stop me if I'm wrong, and I know you will. This is like the most see no government evil administration in my lifetime, and since I'm 175, that's saying a lot. So
you're using racial code words. You're calling them monkeys. Don't call them monkeys.
Oh.
What?
Oh, gosh,
I didn't even get that one.
You heard the dog whistle. Wait.
Wow. Jamie, you get, I'm sorry. Scary. You get extra racism points for that. That was excellent.
Yeah. So the dog whistle has a beat, and we can dance to it. So, but it's just weird. Even the Nixon administration, the evil, horrible Nixon administration that so many people on the liberal side made their bones, developed a reputation, being among them Gary Trudeau, creator of Doonesbury, and Hillary Clinton, and all these people who were so righteous, and basically they wanted a firing squad on the South Lawn of the White House for the things Nixon did. Even people in the Nixon administration said no to the president. He wanted the IRS to do a hit on some enemies, and the IRS director said no.
That's what ethics are cool.
Yeah, when ethics meant something.
It was nice to live in a country like that.
And then, you know, then of course, the other thing was Nixon fired people who refused to, do his evil bidding. Remind me again how many people have been fired in the Obama administration for...
You cannot get fired from that administration.
Can we count that high?
Well, actually, I think it's two. I can only really seriously think of two. And it's going to be a little quiz show right now. But first... We're going to ask Ms. Always Right,
yes,
from her closet, can you name one of the two people in the Obama administration who's been fired just simply for incompetence, much less ethical oversights, complete lack of a moral compass, or being asleep at the wheel?
My goodness, I'm drawing a blank. Was it recent?
Well, we've got 6 years. So you'd think, in the 6 years of the Obama administration with the complete and utter collapse of things like the Obamacare website, which cost $300 million, or was it more than that, Scary Smart?
It was about $600 million less, I heard.
I'm sure it's
well,
more
I,
now.
The one time I undersell Obama's incompetence. okay.
Give or take $100 million.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
What is that among friends, right? He just pick it up on.
What difference does it make?
Right. It does. He just put it on our tab, as usual. The only two people I can come up with, I believe somebody associated with the Obamacare website fell on their sword and were quickly replaced by another incompetent. And I think finally they dragged the VA director out, kicking and screaming and saying, everybody else does it, why are you picking on me?
He was on the verge of retiring. He was going to retire anyway this year.
Wow, so he got the Lois Lerner secret handshake.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the Obamacare person, I think that person was given another position within the government.
Yeah, I don't think anyone was fired. I think you're right.
No.
That sounds familiar to me.
But let's remember, that these people who are doing all these bad things that aren't the president's fault, they all serve at the pleasure of the president. So clearly it pleases him to have them doing these things.
Correct. Yes.
I think a lot of people forget about that.
Yeah.
I know I did, and I'm just going to let that sink in for a minute, that the continued cluster jam of incompetence, especially a lot of these top people, are at the pleasure of the sitting president, Barack Obama. Which reminds me of something else interesting. Since we're speaking about the 500 laser beams that are shooting through his brain at all times, once Barack Obama became president, he took a couple of government agencies that had formerly been standalone and move them under the direction of the president. Can you tell me, scary smart, which two agencies those were?
Census Bureau, and I don't remember the other.
Let me give you a hint. It's a very large organization with a lot of responsibility, a lot of access to private personal information, and they have a really hard time keeping their emails backed up.
I did not know that he moved the IRS like that. That should always be under Treasury.
Yeah, the IRS.
Oh, wow.
So, again, another story our friends in the morally superior media aren't mentioning to us. So, gosh, we've just got a mulligan stew of nastiness here. And I've been ranting. Does someone else want to rant for a while?
I'm actually enveloped in that sickening feeling that I get sometimes when all of this stuff is pointed out.
Yeah.
So I've made you feel bad. That means my work here is done.
Wow.
We're full-on Soviet at this point, you know.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that. You know, Harry Truman, 1950, guy actually done some things in his life. I mean, he failed upward. God bless him. I think those might be some of our best presidents. I've got to be honest. I didn't really want G.W. Bush to be the candidate in 2000. I thought he was the machine's candidate because it seemed like he had failed. But looking back on my own life, I realized we can learn a lot from failure. And that's why I'm here today. But he actually turned out to be a really good president. And then you look at Harry Truman, who was sort of a, you know, he failed as a haberdasher, and he was kind of the machine politician out of Kansas City. But he turned out to be a pretty good president. But these are guys who had actually done stuff. Or community organize, whatever that is.
Well, community organizing is all about raising money, too. It's just in a different way.
That's true.
Because the answer to every single thing in a community organizer's book is we need more money.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's a way of not embezzling it. I'm trying to think of the correct word. Basically shaking it out of the trees. It's kind of a shakedown.
Extortion. Shakedown. Yeah, I like that better.
Yeah.
It's more accurate. I could go on more about the CIA. But basically, they violated the law. They violated their charter. And Dianne Feinstein said, well, that's okay. Don't worry about it. And another Democrat asked them to make a commitment not to do it again. And the DOJ said, yeah, there's nothing to investigate there. And the DOJ has not found anything to investigate as far as the IRS Tea Party harassment.
But they found plenty to investigate when it came to finding out why somebody had given a little bit of extra money to a Republican candidate up in New York State.
Well, one must have their priorities.
Yeah, you can't overlook that extra little $5,000, right?
No. Well, and you know, there's a larger principle at stake, which is, you know, complete suppression of conservative voices in America today.
Yep.
All right. So, thanks. And, you know, the NSA, you know our email address. Go ahead and send those subpoenas right over.
Well, we will be happy to apologize for any laws we broke.
Yeah. And we'll make a commitment, in fact.
Yes, to try to do better. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And when the IRS asks me for my receipts this year, I'll tell them my hard drive crashed, but I'll make a commitment to do a better job backing it up in about 10 years when I have a bigger budget.
Now, I'm just a simple country computer user, but I am able to back up my own computers all the time. I'm just saying.
Wow. You know, there you are.
I have an external drive, and I have it set up, and it backs up. And there it is.
you bomb-throwing radical you. Just stop that.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to turn you in for your own good. I just want you to know that.
Is competence illegal now?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. There's that crazy talk again. okay, ladies. I'm sorry. I've been ranting on. No more coffee for me, Igor. Just put that away.
Well, he keeps getting you the double shot. That's the problem.
You know, he's really not flexible. He has his pattern. He has his routine. He just doesn't want to change it. So
it takes a while for him to get the memo.
Yeah. I do have one more thing about the IRS, if anybody wants to slap that around a little bit.
No, I'm actually learning a great deal. As you mentioned, I was kind of on vacation last week, and I came home to just so many piles of things to do that I'm still really catching up with current events. It was a lovely vacation not to know all this stuff, so... Go ahead, carry on. I'm learning all kinds of things that I missed.
I'm doing what I can to depress you.
You're doing such a bang-up job. Oh, I don't know what to say.
You know, this is one of the nicest things anybody said to me today. There was a new ruling. IRS, you know, is it the infinite Republican squashing machine?
Sure.
Yeah.
That works. Yeah.
Well, just a few days ago, a new thing came out from the IRS. It's just weird to me. They can't keep track of their emails. They don't even know if they have backups. And just as a side note, my disguise as a mild-mannered member of society, I worked in IT for 13 years for a financial institution.
Oh.
And I know, for instance, there were many laws about what we had to back up, what we had to keep. We had to keep 7 years of records. And if we happened to lose those and they weren't available when the various regulatory agencies came by for a little chat, which they did on average of once every 3 months. We were audited about 4 times a year. If we weren't able to produce those, saying oops, making a commitment to do better, just wouldn't have flown. And there would have been people fired. You know, people would have been on. They wouldn't have had time to empty, their pencil case. They would have been out. Their access would have been shut off. And people would have.
If they're lucky, they go to jail. Otherwise, I mean, today, financial institutions, you cannot do that. They come down
absolutely.
Like a ton of bricks on you.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there would have been people in jail and fired.
Correct.
Happily, this is not the case in the IRS.
No, that's a whole different thing. It's all different.
Well, so a new ruling has come out from the IRS, so that the IRS is going to work with certain kinds of groups, atheist groups actually, to monitor. Churches.
I'm sorry, what?
Okay.
What is this?
Okay.
I'm biting my tongue.
All right.
What?
So a lawsuit was filed by a Wisconsin-based Freedom From Religion Foundation. Those are happy people, I'm sure. asserting that the Internal Revenue Service ignored complaints about churches violating their tax-exempt status by routinely promoting candidates from the pulpit. So it's been dismissed without prejudice by a U.S. court judge. And so basically, they are now going to have to work to monitor churches to ensure that they aren't violating, I think it's a 1950 law here. I should have highlighted that. I apologize. It did not. 1954. Which states that tax-exempt groups cannot endorse candidates.
That's
so
true.
A 2009 court ruling, we'll get back to that. A 2009 court ruling determined the IRS must staff someone to monitor church politicking. So the Freedom From Religion Foundation, those happy people, claim the IRS does not adhere to the ruling. What I found interesting is they were worried particularly about rogue churches who were preaching against Obamacare, saying that the contraceptive mandate was a violation of conscience, which I'm not so sure. I agree with that because there's that whole freedom, separation of church and state, and Scary Smart was biting her tongue. I don't want to make you hold back anymore. Go for it.
Oh, yes, you do.
No,
oh,
please,
yes,
no.
You do remember, I am the wife of a sailor. And he doesn't cuss, so I do it all for him.
God love you. And you know what? I think the Internet so far is free from FCC regulation. And as long as Daria doesn't pull the plug on us, let's fly.
No. Because I really would like to appear, at least, to be professional.
Okay.
I would say some bad things. No,
we're running a class act here.
Yeah, there you go. This is insane. First of all, I suspect the first law is a violation of the freedom of speech to begin with.
Yes.
Secondly, where in the hell do they get off using the freedom from religion idiot as a posse comitatus? I mean, you don't deputize people to do your job for you if you're the government.
Especially
not
someone
like that.
So very biased.
I mean, what the hell?
The person who brought the complaint?
There's so much richness here. We could shred for a while, but like for instance, people used it was like a bad thing if we had let's say the CIA sitting in a mosque listening for people encouraging terrorist activity. That that would be a violation, and our friends at the Council on American Islamic Relations, that is CARE, who funnels money to Hamas and other fine organizations like that, would object. And what I find interesting is it was the focus on, again, more of the conservative side of life. I don't know if y'all remember, but during the run-up to the 2012 election, the Obama campaign, it was either Obama for America, Organizing for America, Overreaching for America, whatever it's called. They were working with black churches to make sure people got out and voted for the right guy.
That's true.
And, I just because I am the Prince of White Bread and I wonder about these things, where's the IRS on that?
Here's the problem. I thought the law only covered endorsing specific candidates. Nothing that you just said has anything to do with a specific candidate except what OFA did.
Yes.
All the rest of it is issues. And churches have every right to have a position on issues.
Yes.
Even assuming the original law is constitutional, I don't think it is.
Yeah. Because it states they cannot endorse candidates. Tax-exempt groups cannot endorse candidates, and that's a very specific term. But that's a lot different, as you say, than having a position.
Right.
Yes. And every church all the way back has had a position of some sort.
Yeah. Well, and tax-exempt groups is also a really broad term. Does that mean, what does that do for Norman Lear's People for the American Way? Is that a tax-exempt group? I can't recall.
What does that do to move on?
A lot of them.
Not a thing. Not a thing.
Exactly. That's the problem.
Right. Yeah,
selective,
it's just
selective enforcement.
Very selective. And again, which unfortunately leads me back to that Harry Truman observation I ran across this morning about being worried about a police state. And everybody, just wait a minute. Put on your tinfoil hats.
All right.
And it does feel like we're drifting into a little bit of, it's the sneaky police state. It's the stealth police state in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It cannot be done openly and violently physically because of the Second Amendment. So it is done in all these other ways. But, yeah.
Oh, gosh, that's a great point. That is a frighteningly good point. And we're the only country in the world that has the kind of gun laws we've got.
Right, but it's still being done with all these laws.
I know.
And lacks of enforcement and corruption.
And they're doing it primarily because they know that the opposition, as much as they hate what's going on, still believes in the rule of law.
Yes, and they're using it against us, correct?
Mm-hmm.
It's quite upsetting.
Huh.
I mean, I think
it's vile.
I've said this before. I do think that it... in a lot of ways it has already happened. I think I said this last time I was on the show, that it has already happened, that the government's pretty well rotted out and peopled with, you know, Soviets, basically, whatever you want to call them, communists, fascists, and it's already been done, but just that America had so very much wealth built up that we aren't going to feel it right away, so it happens slowly. So,
yeah.
So they are able to build up their establishment more and more without people actually openly rebelling. And it's going to be pretty far gone by the time the money's gone and everyone feels it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but politically I think it's already done.
Okay. Well, we'll
not irreversibly. Not irreversibly.
Right.
No, it's not irreversible, but by God, if people don't wake up.
It's going to suck for our kids.
I tell my kids all the time, I'm so sorry.
I know.
Yeah, we've done what we could.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
and we still are.
What was that?
I said we still are, so, yeah.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's why we do public service satire right here. We do it for the kids.
Yeah.
That's right.
This is not fun and full of satire today. It's just depressing.
No.
I'm reading, and I just do a quick culture note here. I'm reading a book right now called Tears of Paradox by Daniela Bova. She is an author who's a member of that wonderful Facebook group, Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance. And I'm reading her book, and it's yet another dystopian book. Boy, there sure are a lot of those lately. I wonder what's gotten into everyone, you know. But it's particularly artfully done, and it's just creeping fascism. And so I'm reading it, and it's just very parallel to where we are now, maybe a year or two from now, basically. And there are different names for things. Like they're calling it the new way of doing business. That's what everyone calls it. It's like you were saying, that things are just not enforced anymore. It's just the new way of doing business. And it's like,
wow.
That's putting me in a bad mood, too, because it's like, it's really like a year from now.
I'm going to have to read that. That sounds good.
Yeah, but it starts before the new way of business came along, and you're just going through it, and it's just horrible.
Yeah.
I think everyone should read that. I really do. So it's called Tears of Paradox. I'm not quite halfway through it. It may suck later. I doubt it, though. It's really well written and really well put together. So.
All right. I'm sorry. We have to put you back now.
Yes, sir.
And stay in there until you're in a better mood.
It's your fault.
Well, you know, I think I've got something that's going to cheer you up.
Oh, please.
Okay. All right. I trust me, we can make a deal. The Prince of White Bread would not lie to you about something this important.
Of course.
Sarah Palin? She's stupid.
All right. This is the beginning of our new segment called Sarah Palin is Stupid.
Oh, everyone knows that. Yeah.
Everybody knows. All the best people know that Sarah Palin is stupid. And to honor the fact that all the best people know that, and we've been told that by our intellectual betters like Bill Maher and Jon Stewart, Cher. Katie Couric.
Oh, yeah.
Cher.
Come on.
Those in bars somewhere.
Cher went to Rhodes. Nobody knows that. She went there just in Bill Clinton's backpack. But still, she was at Rhodes. She's a scholar.
I'm sorry, she was?
Okay. Apparently my sarcasm filter is off here.
Oh,
Hold on a second.
Excuse me. I was shocked. Okay. I was right to have been shocked because clearly that's not true. All right, carry on. I'm not.
Oh.
She was a high school dropout in real life, but yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I don't know that much.
All the humanity and all the fascists feeding
her. I totally interrupted you. Please carry on.
I'm sorry. I'm just hurt. You didn't believe me about Cher, but
you just said you wouldn't lie to me about
stuff. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Okay. So. And before I so rudely interrupt you with factual information, so our new segment, which will be, sadly, a long-running and piece, is Sarah Palin is Stupid. And as we've touched on, these intellectual giants, the movers and shakers in our culture, two things which are actually very different, being an intellectual giant, being a mover and shaker in our culture. One only has to look at Jay-Z and Beyonce. They told us for a long time and repeatedly and continually that Sarah Palin is stupid. Mm-hmm. So today I just wanted to salute Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi was once a speaker of the House. Was it the House or the Senate? I believe it was
the House.
Speaker of the House. Speaker of the House. Thank you, Scary Smart. That's why you are Scary Smart.
It wasn't just me.
Yeah, I got that one, too.
Yeah.
Hey.
Points for us, none for you.
Because yes, you got that right, you can come out of your closet.
Thank you.
So Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House before, you know, the evil Republicans took over and they began to destroy everything that was right and good and righteous in America.
Right.
She's been known for a lot of interesting things, to say nothing of her various ethical dilemmas having to do with laws that have been passed that have favored her husband and the millions of dollars he makes. She represents, I believe, the District of San Francisco. They have elected her since before the Great Earthquake of 1906. She's been around for a while. She is often quoted as being somebody who's there for the little people. So this week, Nancy Pelosi was giving an interview, and she was talking about the horrible genocide the Israelis are perpetrating on the innocent, peaceful Palestinian sheep herders who have lived in peace and plenty with their neighbors for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And she actually was using information provided to her by the nation of Qatar,
Qatar,
however you want to say it.
Yeah, they maintain that Hamas is, in fact, a humanitarian organization. They are known for their sing-alongs, their quilting bees, and they're very famous for their pie-eating contests.
They're champion tunnel builders. Kids love it. They love to go down in those tunnels and play.
That whole place is a big beach without the ocean, pretty much.
So when Candy Crowley, amazingly enough, a CNN reporter, said, are you sure about that? And all Nancy Pelosi, with great statesmanlike and clarity and specificity, she went, mm-hmm.
Oh.
So.
Wow.
So remember, Sarah Palin is stupid.
Right.
But Nancy Pelosi is a great leader. But also, I have to say, Nancy Pelosi holds a special special place in our heart this week. Do you know why?
No.
Welcome to this week's edition of Moral Morons.
Because she's a double winner.
Wow.
Nancy Pelosi is a double winner this week. Because anyone who will even say humanitarian organization and Hamas in the same sentence is a moron. You know, anyone who believes in Qatar, even The Guardian, which is a left-wing America is always wrong rag, calls Qatar a funder of terrorism. So anyone who believes Qatar on anything having to do with the Middle East, Israel, Jews, or anything other than the price of oil is a partisan-blinded idiot. If there's ever a movie made about this clown show Congress under the king of clown shows, Barack Obama, I want Shirley MacLaine and her most old lady baddie to portray Pelosi. And, in fact, I was discussing with Scary Smart, who suggested that maybe Nancy Pelosi's in the running for that special award. Why don't you tell him about that, Scary Smart?
Oh, yeah, put me on the spot when I don't even know what I'm talking about right now.
Oh, wait, let me read it. I still have the email right here. It was so good.
That would be the better way to do it.
Okay. Let's see. Can't make lunch on Friday. How about wrong one. Let's see. Scary Smart, who is pretty smart and has a lot on her plate. She has a lot more laser focused going on than Barack Obama, even.
Yes.
She suggested that we inaugurate the Lifetime Achievement Award in moral moronitude. That would be L-A-A-M-M-E. Mm. It would be the LAME award for short.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna put that in the hopper because I think Nancy Pelosi is a strong candidate for the LAME award from the Right Wing Riot.
Yeah, she's gonna be tough to beat.
Yeah, she is the one to beat. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But that was a special double winner this week, Nancy Pelosi. Thanks very much for being the moral moron of the week and proving once again that Sarah Palin is stupid because the smart people told us so.
Yeah. That was amazing.
Yeah.
God, that woman.
It makes me proud not to be from San Francisco.
I couldn't live there. That's what they elect there. I couldn't.
Yeah. All right. So I failed. Igor's failed. I'm going to be flogging Igor later, actually, for his failure. Igor.
Igor. Dude, the show's starting.
Igor, damn it.
Igor.
What the hell? Are you okay?
Igor is, you know, I just get to talk to him. I hate to do it. He's such a sensitive soul.
Can you get him some peanuts or something to calm him down?
You know, he's like gone straight to the jiffy. You know, he's
I'm sorry to hear that. I thought he kicked
just,
that.
That sorry. Just goes right up the trunk. You know, it's really easy that way. But, okay, so I've totally lost my thought. But Igor and I have failed as producers. I was trying to blot that from my memory. One of the things I was supposed to do was create the show format. And Igor, have you ever seen an elephant type? I mean, they're just rough on a type. It's wow, wow. So I have to do that. One of the things that was suggested by the Scary Smart crew was that we include a little cultural break, a few chats on what's going on in the world. You already did that. By yourself, Ms. Always Right.
I'm sorry, I totally went out of sequence. I was moved.
You were feeling the vibe. And,
it was. It just totally made me think of that book.
Yeah, that's why we love you because.
Sorry.
I'd say that's why we love you because you're intuitive that way, and you just work with us. It's like a jam session right here every week.
You're a very powerful leader, Prince, and you were able to completely depress me and ruin my vacation and remind me of what's going on in the world, and you did it, like, really quickly and really well, and it just reminded me of that book terribly.
I feel better about myself now. Thank you.
Yeah, you said you're an evil, evil leader. You're very good.
Okay.
I happily follow.
Very good. I will remember that at Christmas. There will be a little something extra in your envelope.
Okay. Okay. I was just going to qualify. That's okay. Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
So Scary Smart, that was your idea. Any cultural things kind of percolating there in that cauldron of brain of yours?
A couple of things. Just got an email that one of our writers at Liberty Island is now a featured pick on Powerline.
Oh.
For his story on Liberty Island, Dark and Stormy, that would be Michael Sheldon. Haven't read it yet. Now I have to.
Okay,
that's
awesome.
That is awesome. But there's another interesting thing I saw today. There's a very special person who's working for Obama.
Uh-huh.
He's a fiction writer. He has published a short one short story that we know of called The Goldfish Smiles, You Smile Back. And it's a really cool story. It's about a guy that has an incredible gift for note-taking. And here's a little snippet from the story. My notes are so impressive that they have taken on the form of ideas. I capture other people's words in a manner that not only organizes them, but inserts a clarity and purpose that was not present in the original idea. Now, doesn't that kind of sound like he's taking other people's ideas and spinning them a little bit?
Sure.
Well, okay. He's Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah, something like that. Well, here's the thing. He is Ben Rhodes, the National Security Advisor, and apparently all you need in order to be Obama's National Security... Yes, this is true.
Well,
this is
come
all true.
On, you guys.
All you
come
need
on.
In order to be Obama's National Security Advisor is to have a master's degree in fiction and to write a story about making things fictional when you take notes. Now, remember, Ben Rhodes is the guy who edited the Benghazi talking points that went out with Susan Rice.
Oh. Well,
you mean
a fiction writer, too.
The talking points that fictionally referred to a very crummy YouTube video as the reason the Benghazi embassy was besieged for 20 hours by people who brought mortars and hand grenades to a spontaneous riot against the YouTube video. Would that be the same Ben Rhodes?
You can't make this shit up.
Oh, yay, our first curse word. Hooray.
Yes. Well, I had
because
to.
Because I was
in
very
that particular
close.
Context. I mean, seriously.
What the hell?
That's what I said.
That's our national security advisor?
Yes.
Does anyone give a crap about this country at all in our government? What the hell?
I don't know.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
I sent you guys
I heard
the
he's
going
to hire a baker to be the Joint Chiefs of Staff next. What the hell? Come on.
Wow.
Oh, a baker? Only one that bakes politically correct? Like
well,
rainbow
that's the only qualification you need, and then you can do freaking anything. Isn't Kagan, now that we think about it, was she not ever a judge at all, now that I think about it? I'm sorry, jumping to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
I don't think she was ever a judge. Yeah.
Yeah, but she's a wise Latina. So.
Right. No, that's the other one. I'm talking about Kagan.
Elena Kagan. Yeah, yes,
my bad. So she's qualified somehow to be a Supreme Court justice, even though she's never been a judge. But then we have a guy who never ran a hot dog stand who is now the president of the most powerful country in the world. So, yeah, I guess
Kagan.
Qualifications are right up there with laws in this country and that they are not important anymore. So. Oh,
Kagan's
so
qualification. Kagan's qualification is that she's gay. He wanted a rainbow Supreme
she's
Court.
She's gay?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
She won't admit it.
Okay, then I totally understand. That clears everything up. Okay.
All my
you.
Legal fantasies are just ruined right now. Thanks, Jamie.
Yeah. Hey, maybe you can get a twofer. Think about it.
Oh, God.
Yeah, you're not thinking right.
I'm not open-minded enough, apparently.
No, you got to work that to your advantage, guy. I think I went too far. I'm sorry.
You did. I mean, I can take some shit, but that's like, well.
Wow, we're all cursing now. Wow.
No.
This show is like a first in so many ways.
Yeah.
I think I broke you.
We're edgy and transgressive. That's us.
Yeah, and we're no longer a class act. To hell with that.
Yeah.
This is war, okay?
Okay, so. Okay, so we've got the fiction advisor, the fiction writer.
National security advisor, come on.
Advisor. I like that.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, it's a new category. Wow, that's crazy. I mean, I've said some of the same things, but wow.
Because we have a clown in the White House who's just going to do whatever the hell he wants. No one stops him. If you do, you're going to get destroyed as a racist. No one can. This is a really unfortunate situation. So,
that means we're qualified to work in the White House now.
We're more qualified than the president. We always have been. Because we have had real jobs and been responsible for things.
That's true.
Yeah. So. I think cat turd is more qualified to be president. For that's just my opinion.
Okay, wait. I don't know. That. You may have crossed the line there.
Oh, not again. Damn it. All right, I'm sorry. Here I go. Bye.
Yeah,
sorry.
Okay. Well, once more, the show's gone off the rails.
It's a riot. Woo!
It is.
We're rioting. Yeah.
Okay. Stop! They're burning Starbucks. Okay.
Don't do that. I can deal with that.
All right, everybody settle down.
They're looting Whole Foods. Stop them now.
Oh, that's okay.
Wow. I do want to come back to that one, Scary Smart. Let's make a note that we need to delve into that some more because that is that's the kind of stuff if we put on the show, they'd say, oh, you guys, quit kidding. Of course they're not going to have a fiction writer on the National Security Advisory Council. I mean, you know, they have lawyers. They have guys
advisor.
With, like...
He's the top guy.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, wow.
Yeah.
I want to tell you the story.
Yeah, we're going to have to look at that because, I mean, maybe he wrote great espionage thrillers and they said, hey, you know, this guy, he can think outside the box.
That would actually make me feel better if he had written some espionage thrillers.
Yeah, but he's probably thinking outside the box labeled facts, you know, because Benghazi talking points did occur in a rather fact-free zone. But, we'll go back to that. You know what? I have to be honest. I do feel bad for bumming out Ms. Always Right. She came back from a lovely, restful vacation. And sorry, I'm laughing at your pain. It's...
Oh, my God, this is really funny. I'm glad it's making you laugh.
Wow. I'm going to do this every week now.
I'll leave the show then. I don't have to be here. I have other things I could do.
You're going to flounce like a special snowflake?
I'm hurting right now, okay? I'm kind of hurt.
Well, this always makes me feel bad.
Yes, I feel better now. Yes,
I'm glad.
Thank you.
But, you know, after all this upsetting talk, it's time for a little something more soothing to our souls, if the soundboard works right.
It's time for another fable from the big book of comforting fairy tales for delicate liberals. Read for you by Uncle Prince of White Bread. Once upon a time, there was a little red hen. She lived on a farm with all kinds of animals, and like any good red, she believed that the proletariat should rise up against the farmer to bring about the promised earthly paradise in which all animals would live, from each according to their means to each according to their needs. One day, she decided she wanted some bread. Well, of course, the farmer only brought her corn, because he was saving all the soft, tasty wheat for himself, the evil capitalist. So she gathered together a few dozen kernels of leftover corn.
What's a capitalist, Uncle Prince?
Well, Pajama Boy, a capitalist is a terrible exploiter of the proletariat who controls the means of production and claims he built his business on his own when we know...
They didn't build it themselves. They sound like bad people.
Oh, they are, Pajama Boy. And they have a terrible fashion sense. So the little red hen said, I'm going to plant some corn. Would any of my comrades care to help?
Nay, said the horse. And baa from the goat. The rooster just crowed.
Well, I'll just plant them myself. I'm best at scratching in the dirt anyway.
So she did, planting and watering the grains of corn painstakingly.
Would any comrade care to help me tend the plants?
She said daily. And do you know what they said to her?
The rest of the animals were already providing according to their means.
You are so smart. At last, the day came to harvest the corn. Now the hen was very good at digging and scratching, but she wasn't so very good at cutting plants down.
Comrades, I could use a hand, or a claw, or a hoof.
What happened then, Pajama Boy?
All of the other animals were busy, Uncle Prince, each according to their means. She shouldn't have asked, because she had the means to do it herself, and she should have.
So she sized up the task. She pecked at the ear. It took 6 or 7 pecks each, and she was exhausted in the end. But at last, a dozen fresh ears of corn lay in a row before her.
I can use some help grinding, comrades. Surely one of you hoofed ones might be able to do me that favor.
She wasn't very smart for a red hen.
Reds aren't known for their big brains. She found 2 rocks and rolled them over and over the corn, until it cracked and turned into powder. It took her days, but she had her flour for bread.
Anyone up for baking?
She clucked, but the other animals ignored her because they were busy doing the people's work.
Now, baking was far easier than planting and tending and harvesting and grinding. And soon, the tempting aroma of fresh bread filled the coop and then the barnyard. And do you know what happened next, Pajama Boy?
Uh-huh. The little red hen became greedy and wanted to keep the bread all for herself instead of sharing it with the workers. But Dear Leader came and redistributed it, because at some point, you've made enough bread.
Time for bed now. Be sure to say your prayers to Dear Leader so he'll look after you for the rest of your days.
Good night, Uncle Prince. I just love Dear Leader more than anything in the whole wide world.
We know you do, Pajama Boy.
Okay, that'll be a regular feature on the Right Wing Riot. That is from the Big Book of Comforting Fairy Tales for Delicate Liberals. And that comforting tale was brought to you from Scary Smart, Jamie K. Wilson, who wrote that.
Yay. Bravo.
Okay. Well,
and
that takes us...
excellent reading, too, I might add.
Oh, thank you.
That was pretty impressive that you got Pajama Boy to make a cameo appearance there.
You know, he loves those kind of comforting fairy tales. And
he's
going to be back.
Absolutely.
In fact, I'm going to start a Right Wing Riot YouTube channel, and I think the Big Book of Comforting Fairy Tales, The Little Red Hen, will be the first of the YouTubes we put up as soon as I have that book cover, which I've been promised soon.
Yes. Did I mention I've been on vacation?
Once or twice.
Do you know what? I am producing... to my ability. I am doing my best here. Okay.
Okay. And but that's your ability, your means, but I have needs. I'm just saying.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Well, you need to produce according to your needs. So I will certainly step it up. I apologize.
Yeah. You do that. All right. We have 3 minutes left. Anything else you want to add there, Scary Smart?
I think I'm good. I'm done. I broke you guys. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to take me at least a week to recover from this one.
And what an interesting coincidence. We have a show again in a week, just as you're feeling strong.
Just in time. Hey, that's awesome.
It just works out that way. And Ms. Always Right, anything else you want to bring up?
No, I think you guys have done enough for 1 week. So.
We've harmed you enough this week.
Yeah, I'm going to creep back into my closet. I've had it. Okay.
Well,
goodbye.
Yeah, goodbye. Thanks for joining us again, Ms. Always Right. This has been another edition of the Right Wing Riot. Our website will be up soon. Won't it, Scary Smart? Web mistress?
Yep.
Yes, it will be up soon. And we will have that YouTube channel up for you as well. Thank you for joining us. And this has been... the Right Wing Riot, as soon as I find the button I'm supposed to push. Igor!
For the love of God, turn the show off. Jeez.
We're out of time for today's riot. You can find us on the web at rightwingriot.com. No hyphen, all one word. Right Wing Riot. Thanks to our generous internet radio host, Daria Ann DiGiovanni.